I was all alone. My times of trouble and pain. I used to think there was no one else who felt the cold and rain. Then I woke up to humanity. We were standing
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to another edition of The Balancing Point. Hope you're all feeling in balance out there, ready to move into the fall, into the autumn, this change of season, when it's time to pull back just a little, to start wrapping up projects, getting ready for the hibernation of winter. So, again, this is the time of year when you want to start wrapping things up, not starting new stuff. So hopefully you're starting to relax into that, maybe putting a little more time in your meditation practice or reviving an old practice that you haven't been doing for a while. So I'm here with you this morning. This is Dr. John Nieders, Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine, and I would love to speak with you about any area of health and healing. And from a classical Chinese perspective, which many of my teachers were classically trained, from a TCM perspective, which is traditional Chinese medicine, which is the integration, actually, of biomedicine and Chinese classical Chinese medicine that has been taking place in China and around the world since the 1950s, and even more so from the 60s. So anything that you want to talk about, I would love to go into with you today and see if we can help create more balance in the world. It was actually it was kind of funny the other day. I don't know if I've mentioned this on the air, but I was recently elected, appointed, whatever you do with that, president of the Academy of Chinese Culture and Health Science, the Oakland Acupuncture School. And someone was saying, "Well, isn't that kind of a different thing, or isn't that energetically very different?" And the answer is, really, no, it's not. It's the same activity that I do every day. My patient sits down, or in that case, I go into a school and I do my diagnostic techniques. I listen, I take the pulse, I watch in my patients their eye patterns, their movement patterns, their breathing patterns. In the school, I watch those same things, rather than a group of cells, it's a group of people, and you look for energy blockages, you look for places where the chi is deficient, you look at places where there is disharmony, and then you create a treatment plan, and then you do it, you carry out the treatment plan. And so these principles, and I mention that because the Chinese, in looking at the human body and the energetic systems, felt that the human body was a microcosm of this giant macrocosm of the earth and then of the universe as a whole. And indeed, that's true. The same principles are at play throughout the universe, and they were quite aware of that. And so they're descriptors of how to devise treatment plans and how to do diagnosis really were very consistent with the macrocosm, with the world as a whole. So the same principles that work with human beings also work with organizations of human beings. And so it's kind of an interesting dynamic. So let's go ahead. I think there's someone already on the line. Let's go ahead and take a call. Hello?
Hi, John.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Who's this?
My name is Joanne.
Hi, Joanne.
Yes, I have a two-part question. The first question is for my husband and the second for me. The first question is, my husband is anticipating, rather tenuously, a PSA test
mm-hmm.
that the doctor has ordered for him next week. And he is a man who had a vasectomy at about 26 years old
mm-hmm.
after two children and African-American mixed race. And so I wanted to speak about that and your thoughts on that. He's considering not doing the test.
Mm-hmm.
The second question is for myself. I recently had to go to Stanford Emergency because I had an issue where I swelled up in my abdomen and went in, and they did a an abdominal CAT scan,
mm-hmm.
and there were no masses, no stones, no diverticuli, no tumors. But what they did find was something called a sclerosing mesenteritis, which apparently is an inflammation of the around the bowel, fatty tissue around the bowel.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no real protocols for treatment. There are people who do have tumors that can be cancerous or tumors that are benign. But at this point, you know, he did say continue on with your acupuncture, which I'd gone to. But the only option would be to do a steroid-type drug, which I wouldn't do. So I will take my answers off the air.
Okay.
And,
well, hang on before you go. Did they have any sense of what was causing the sclerosing?
You know, they don't know. They just, it's like a mystery. I mean, I'd been a little constipated, and then the week prior I'd had a colonoscopy. But they don't feel that there was any connection between the inflammation. There was a slight inflammation of the jejunum mm-hmm. in the lower intestinal area.
And did they think that could be related to the...
they thought perhaps that the colonoscopy, you know, I might have been a little bit... So they didn't feel like there was anything too terribly wrong with that. But I got a call back 2 days later from the emergency room doctor indicating there was this thing that they did find after searching more,
mm-hmm.
and it was this sclerosing. And so I'm trying not to, you know, go too far out with my anxiety and just really...
Yeah, one more question. Did they think that there was any kinking or, fixing or... tortuous colon at all?
You know, I have to go back to the gastroenterologist who did the colonoscopy
mm-hmm.
to see
okay.
what his thought. I have to have my follow-up with him.
Yeah, but, just before you get out there, that's a pretty rare problem.
Right.
You know, it doesn't come up very often. I think I've seen it once, probably. I'm trying to think if there was someone else, but I think once. And the danger is, you know, that the thickening could block the bowel, or that if it kinks, it could block the bowel, and then that can be a very serious problem. And did they? What is their follow up plan on it?
He gave me no follow up plan. He just basically said, we could give you some immune suppressant drugs,
mm-hmm.
but we don't even know that those work. And at this time, there's no real protocol. I did see a YouTube video that. A woman who had a tumor and was benign had opted to not have surgical removal and is being treated at the Mayo Clinic, obviously with drug therapies, and opted to not have the tumor removed.
Are you willing to stay on the air for a minute?
Sure.
Okay, because I may have some more questions. Well, one is a couple things. You know, the sclerosing means that it's basically thickened, scarred tissue, and it could become tumors, but the sclerosing just means that. And there, typically, when we see that, there is some type of inflammatory process. So I suspect that those drugs that they were talking about might have some benefit. Of course, they come with huge lists. I mean, if you ever listen to the commercials on TV, it's almost like a Saturday Night Live skit, mm-hmm. Here we can get rid of this problem you have, this minor problem, and then, the list of side effects is one that, make your eyes roll around. So that, I think there, in terms of reducing inflammation, I think there are probably some things that you can do to certainly help. There are quite a few Chinese herbal formulas, and if you're seeing an acupuncturist, you might talk to them about a long-term anti-inflammatory formula. There are some things that are better short-term, but they can cause some other issues, if you kind of like antibiotic problems if you use them long-term. But there are some good anti-inflammatory long-term programs. When I see, yours is internal. When I see sclerosing tissue on the surface, scleroderma being one of the classics, or Dupuytren's contracture, things like that, where we have connective tissue that is either overgrowing, it is overgrowing and it's become thickened and not brittle, but it doesn't expand as much. You can't stretch it as well because it's too thick. Acupuncture is fabulous for that, a combination of acupuncture and liniments that you can rub in. One of the things, and is this all large bowel problem or is it small?
You know, that's a great question.
To me, that's the most important question.
I need to call back and ask that question. Yeah, I don't know.
If it's small bowel, and you'd mentioned that they had some problems in the jejunum, but it didn't sound like that you didn't specifically say there was sclerosing around there. If it's small bowel, I would think it's a little trickier. The small bowel is designed to absorb nutrients, and because of the way it's designed, it's hard, in my experience, to kind of leak things through, where in the large bowel, it's very easy. For example, in endometriosis, obviously a very different condition, but in severe, intractable endometriosis, we actually treat that with herbal enemas and retention enemas, where we'll have women retain the fluid for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, or hopefully until the fluid's absorbed. And what happens when it gets absorbed, it actually, some of that will leak through and affect the tissues around the bowel. And so if it's in the large bowel, that's one of the things I would consider, is almost an endometriosis, with a couple changes, basically an endometriosis formula, which is going to, what you have there is stasis. You have mostly phlegm damp from a Chinese standpoint, but also probably some qi and blood stasis, certainly. Certainly qi stasis, probably blood stasis. And so I would think about doing an enema that moves qi, blood, and phlegm. And which is very, very similar to formulas that we would do as an enema for ovarian cysts, because those tend to be qi, phlegm, blood-type cysts. Mm-hmm. So I would kind of look maybe in that direction to do some form of have your acupuncturist do, you know, if they're not familiar with it, do a little research and maybe come up with an enema formula so that it can go across into those tissues. And I say that again because we get such great results when it's topical by using liniments and things on that. If I find it on the surface again in the, like a scleroderma or a Dupuytren's contracture or something like that, I will have patients put iodine on it and massage iodine in it along with the herbs, and then also take some oral iodine. Iodine's very, very good for whenever we have thickened phlegm, thickened mucus, etc. The actual name historically for hypothyroid is myxedema, which essentially is thickened edema, and it'll show off often along the front of the legs, pretibial myxedema. And so iodine is very effective at dealing, or seaweeds with a lot of iodine in them have been used for thousands or at least many hundreds of years in Chinese medicine to start dissolving that. So you might check your iodine levels. There are tests for that, or you can just start, you know, take a little iodine, make sure you're not allergic to it, and start building up with the iodine.
Okay, I did receive a powdered organic iodine that gives, you know, a very, very high volume of iodine in just a little shake in your hand. It's an organic, it's a kelp.
Okay. Yeah, the kelp sometimes works, and some, you know, the kelp actually is great, and that's in Chinese medicine. We use seaweeds. At really, really high volumes, though, sometimes I worry about it because as well as pulling up iodine, it may pull up other heavy metals. And so, you know, it really depends on how much and for how long I'm going to be using it. So, you know, I would work with your acupuncturist on that and kind of work through that. But you may want to go to a different form. I like Lugol's solution. It's a very I use it for lots and lots of stuff, but tip, you know, for everything from thyroid conditions to these thickened conditions, breast lumps in women, cysts, things like that. I'll have women massage it directly, and often they just magically disappear. So I think you're on the right track there. And then, you know, think about doing perhaps an enema, but if not, do some Chinese herbs that may go across the bowel and start, you know, working on that thickened tissue.
Very good. And if you want to answer the PSA question,
okay.
My husband is at work listening.
Okay.
close ears.
That's
thank
a, thank
so
you.
Much, John.
All righty. Bye-bye. PSA. very, very interesting. You know, we have so many, I'm going to digress for a moment. You know, one of the things that we see is once a pharmaceutical is created or, you know, patented, they'll start looking for diseases to fit it. And we see this all the time where a disease that social anxiety disorder, you know, we used to call it being shy, but being shy doesn't really warrant a drug. So when we had drugs that seemed to kind of help people get over that, then suddenly we had social anxiety disorder with this big black cloud, and now we have drugs to treat that. So it actually becomes a disease. And so we have dozens of those diseases now in our medical system. The same thing sometimes goes with testing. There really was a method to my getting there. And PSA test is one of those. So there are many writers in the kind of, I'm going to call it alternative medicine, that really do not like the PSA test. There are so many problems with that test. For one, there are many conditions that can raise the PSA which are not a cancer problem. And it's kind of like, again, I'm going to digress for a moment, it's like this tremendous use of ever more powerful mammography machines. And the more powerful the mammography machines, the more false positives we have. And there are tens of thousands of women that get that phone call from their doctor saying, come back, we've got to do another mammogram or some other procedure. And women are scared to death, and they often then end up having biopsies done on benign problems. And there are very good reasons not to do those procedures. Same with the PSA. PSA is a it's prostate-specific antigen, and it's a very so I'm not against people taking having a PSA done. That's not the problem. It's very misleading. For example, if a man has a digital rectal exam where they, you know, a doctor puts their finger in the anus and feels the prostate to see if there are signs that might be cancerous or checking the size of the prostate. After that test is done, you have to wait quite a while before you do a PSA, because that test, that touching of the prostate, will release chemicals that will cause the PSA to rise. So any number of things can cause the PSA to skyrocket. Now, so my problem with the test isn't the test. I think the test is fine. I think it's fine to do it as long as you realize going in that it is not a superb test. It does not measure cancer. It measures inflammation in the prostate that can be caused by many, many things. And if it is high, you probably want to have repeat tests done over time, and it's really more the trend that you're looking for. Now, if the PSA comes in, you know, astronomically high, maybe it's worth having it, you know, it's always worth having it visualized, ultrasound or some other thing, and maybe it's worth being biopsied. But if it's just slightly elevated, and your doc wants to do a procedure, I would get a second opinion. Of course, I always recommend getting a second opinion before any invasive procedure is done. Anytime you do a procedure into the body, there is some risk. And I am a big favorite of getting a second opinion. And then, if it's not a surgical intervention, at least, and sometimes even if it is, get a third opinion by someone completely out of the field. So if you're going to your MD and they say you need to go on, or you need to have surgery on your back or your knee or whatever, I would get a second opinion on that, and then I would get a third opinion from someone in a different field who may have something outside the box to do. And I say that based on my personal experience. I was told that I had to have surgery on my bowel. This was in my late 20s, and I was having horrific gut and bowel problems, put me in the hospital. In fact, put me in emergency room. I nearly died from anaphylactic shock, and the prognosis is we need to do surgery. I said, you know, I'm going to go back to my Chinese doctor who, when I was told I had that back surgery before, he gave me some herbs. I didn't have the back surgery. And the doctor's response is, okay, if you want to kill yourself, go ahead. Well, if I had had that bowel surgery, I guarantee there would be some problem, some side effect from that. There couldn't not be. And it's now been 35 years, and I have no problem with the problem that I had before. That's why I say go to someone outside the box. My first exposure to acupuncture was when I was told by two different surgeons, one doctor and then another surgeon, that I had to have back surgery. This was in my early 20s, and one of my friends said, well, why don't you go try acupuncture? I knew nothing about acupuncture, but rather than having my spine carved up, I decided to try it, and went to this wonderful doctor in Berkeley. He started me on herbs, changed my lifestyle, changed my diet, gave me some specific exercises. Didn't even do acupuncture, actually. Did everything else, and within 6 months, my back felt great, and I have had nothing more than minor back problems since then, and I have zero pain in my back today, and that's been very nearly 40 years. I was told I had to have knee surgery because of a torn meniscus problem. I examined my shoes, I examined my gait, I changed my Tai Chi form, and within 6 months, I had no knee pain, and the meniscus doesn't bother me at all, zero. So that's three surgeries that I personally didn't get because I went to I got a second opinion inside from another MD inside the box, and then I went outside the box to someone else. In a couple cases, they were acupuncturists. In one case, it was a chiropractor, and then my own exercise system. So you really, really need to do your homework. You know, it's not enough to rely on these expert opinions as, God's word, because they are operating in a very constrained, closed system, and they tend to not look outside that system. And I say that based on the fact that I still run into medical doctors who say there have never been any valid studies done on acupuncture, and then you look on Medscape and you find 17,000 studies on Medscape alone. And so, again, they're not looking outside the box. They're great at what they do, but if you're a hammer, you'll look for a nail. That's what you do. And so you always want to get another opinion. So again, back to the PSA test, it is a very non-specific test for prostate cancer. There are many things that can trigger it. It's fine to have it as long as you're aware that you may want to get a second opinion if it shows a problem. On the other hand, if it's very low, you're probably okay, and then you can sleep better at night and breathe easier. So once again, I'm not anti the test. I'm anti the fear that gets created out of the test. And even then, we know that in prostate cancers, that the difference between people that do watchful waiting, meaning kind of just watching the progression of the prostate cancer versus those that take very aggressive action, is about 1%. About 1% of people die with prostate cancer that's diagnosed if they take very aggressive action, and about 2% die if they just watch and wait. There are now better ways to tell whether there's the aggressive form of prostate cancer or the less aggressive, and that's really probably where the decision point might be considered in working with your medical doctor. Again, acupuncturists cannot treat cancer, and I don't give advice to patients about cancer other than I'm always willing to give the advice, get a second opinion. That's valid no matter what. So I don't know if that helps or not. Don't stress. If the finding is not too good, then get a second opinion. If it's good, then go have a beer and relax and have a good night's sleep. Okay. Thank you for the call, by the way. So we have many of these tests. You know, we have TSH tests. We have the mammograms. We have a lot of tests that then subject people to much higher levels of invasive procedures. So that's a bit of a problem. There was a study done or reported in the International Journal of Cancer a while back, and they were looking at supplementation with antioxidants, and they were using green tea extracts, soy extract, vitamin E, I don't know if I said selenium, but selenium, and then some other plant-based phytosterols and sterols. And the other people, you know, took a placebo. And what they found is that those that, and they regularly checked the PSA levels, okay? And what they found is those that took the supplements did far, far better in follow-up than did those that that did not. So again, this is really unfortunate that so many people are given the PSA test and then very radical procedures done on that. So again, protect your prostate. Do all those things that I just mentioned. The studies have also shown very clearly that the intake of any type of fiber reduces prostate cancer risk slightly, but that soluble fiber intake gave some protection, but when vegetable fiber provided the lowest risk. So fruit was good, grain was okay in terms of fiber, but vegetable fiber significantly lowered prostate cancer risk. Now, that makes really good sense. The prostate sits in a location right almost up against the bowel wall, the large intestine wall. That's why doctors can, insert the finger in the anus and actually feel the prostate gland. And so that's how close it's lying to that bowel wall. So if you don't have good bowel habits, for example, again, the average in the United States is one bowel movement every 3 days, whereas in indigenous cultures, and even still in China, the average is 3 bowel movements a day. So that's 9 times more often that people move their bowels. And that's pretty much a function of fiber intake. In the U.S., the last time I looked, the average fiber intake was about 11 grams. In China, the average fiber intake was 33 grams. So that's a really significant difference. And so if the bowels aren't moving regularly, those toxic products that are supposed to get out of the system sit there. So again, if you have a bowel movement 3 times a day versus 1 every 3 days, that fecal matter is going to sit there for days, literally for days. And the function of the large intestine primarily is to absorb. It's to absorb the water out of that fecal matter back into the body so you don't waste too much fluid. Well, that means that there's a lot of permeability. So those waste products can cross the bowel, certainly, and could be what's causing the effect on the prostate. And that could explain why people with a high vegetable diet have dramatically lower prostate risk. Also, though, other factors, we know that with a large vegetable intake, particularly of cruciferous vegetables, sulforaphanes and sulfur-rich vegetables, again, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, things like that, that those actually cause a change in how hormones are broken down. And with estrogen, it's the 2,16 hydroxyestrogen. So if you have those molecules present, then estrogen tends to break down on this 2 pathway, which is very favorable. And if it's not present, the estrogen tends to break down on the 16 pathway, which is very proliferative and is indicated in a variety of reproductive cancers. And similar things happen with the prostate cancers. So again, the key here is, in fact, even before you go get the PSA test, try doing lots and lots. Clean up your diet. Do everything right. Make sure you're up to at least a couple bowel movements a day. Do lots of antioxidants to kind of calm things down, and then go in and get checked. Okay, talked about that enough, I guess. So let's go ahead and take another call. Hi, this is Dr. Neeters.
Good morning, Dr. Neeters. This is Mahesh. I'm calling in from New Delhi, India.
From New Delhi. That may be a record, Mahesh. Thank you. Good to talk to you.
We'd like to thank you so much, a few of us that listen to you here. Thank you so much for the information that you put out there. It's really helped me personally. I've recently had a full body checkup in which every other number came out fine, but there was some worry about my cholesterol numbers. And when the doctor sort of prompted me to look at statins, I knew that I had a few more tests to undergo, having listened to your shows, both The Balancing Point and The Medicine Men, through iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that I had to get my C-reactive protein tested. You know, I needed to look at my uric acid score. I also needed to check if I was pre-diabetic in any way, even though my sugar numbers were fine. So I've got all of them on board, and, you know, it's thanks to you. And now I'm trying to understand these numbers, and that's basically what I'm calling about.
Wow, thank you. I feel very honored that you call, and really excited that you've gotten so much information. It's so touching to me to be able to kind of reach out and touch someone in India. It's very exciting for me because you're doing all the right things, it sounds like to me. So what were your cholesterol numbers?
These numbers are given to us in mg per deciliter, doctor. So I'm not sure if these are comparable to, I think, the MMOLs that you use in the United States.
Not. Can you give them to me anyway?
Yeah, total cholesterol was 238 mg per dl.
Mm-hmm.
Triglycerides were at a 181.
Mm-hmm.
HDL was around 42.
I'm sorry, HDL?
HDL, high-density lipoprotein, was 42.
Right.
LDL was 162.
Okay.
And I went ahead and got a C-reactive protein test done yesterday, and that came out at 19 mg per deciliter, which I suspect is 1.9 mg per liter by the U.S. standard.
Is that high sensitivity, do you know? What is the range that they have?
Yes, it is, sir. Yes, it is. Having listened to you, I made sure that I got a high sensitivity C-reactive protein test done.
And what range do they show on there, just to make sure that I get tracking the units?
Well, they actually show a range which is a lot larger. I think it goes up to 50. 0 to 10 to 50 is what they show, which is probably a 1 to 5.
Okay.
And on that, I was a 1.9.
Okay. Well, the first thing that stands out to me, or the first couple things, are the triglyceride numbers. And I think this looks like easy to decipher. The triglycerides look high. Are you a vegetarian?
Yes, I am, sir.
Okay. I often see this particular pattern in vegetarian, particularly vegetarian men, where the HDL is, they probably show a normal range up to about 39 or 40.
Yeah. No, my HDL is considered to be below par. I think I need to be at a 55 plus in order to be at par. I am at a 42.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. One of the things about lab tests is they will, the quote normal ranges will vary by country, and they'll vary internally by different labs, right? And you've heard me talk about that, I'm sure, on the cholesterol testing or the TSH testing.
Absolutely.
You know, what is quote normal can vary by almost a factor of 100% depending on the lab. So at any rate, 42 is too low. And my other concern is the triglycerides at 181. Typically, when I see that, it's going to be a relatively high grain or carbohydrate diet with a low to and a pretty low protein to fat diet frequently, and so the triglycerides are going to be caused by a little excess sugar in the blood that's not being utilized and then is being put together in these long triglyceride chains. So that that's a little bit of a concern. I would certainly, a couple things, it's tricky for vegetarian men to get that HDL number up. With men who are eating some meat, often we can get it up by increasing fish oil considerably and by doing high-intensity exercise. So in your case, you certainly want to be doing some high-intensity exercise, and you want to get the longest chain omega-3 fatty acids that you can, which is probably going to be ALA for you or flax oil. And doing quite a bit of that. I would combine the flax oil. I would go online and look at Johanna Budwig, B-U-D-W-I-G, a German doctor who has some very innovative ways of using flax with cottage cheese and some other things to really increase the ability to assimilate it. So I don't know if you can. Could you do cottage cheese? Hello? Oh, sounds like we lost him. Okay, so I'm just going to talk about this for a moment. But I would check out Johanna Budwig, B-U-D-W-I-G, looking at absorption, the ability to utilize the fairly long chain omega-3 fatty acids, but not the longest chain, and that we need those to be able to get that HDL level up. This is a little bit of a stress profile. The CRP is okay, but I'd love to get it a little bit lower. So, again, high antioxidant levels, lots of green tea in particular. Again, I wanted to ask him about his blood pressure, and so that would determine whether I would use a few other supplements.
Can you hear me, Dr. Nita?
Oh, now I can hear you again. How's your blood pressure?
Yes. The call dropped, and then I called back into KEST. I've just begun to hear your reply again from the point where you're speaking about the C-reactive protein score being okay, but you're worried about my antioxidant level.
Yes, I definitely want to get those up because when although the C-reactive protein is well in range, and I wouldn't worry about that typically, I have a slight concern about that level of C-reactive protein, given that the HDL to LDL level is skewed in that way. Though your blood sugars look okay, with that high of a triglyceride level and that low of an HDL, that still can be the beginnings, the very early beginnings of metabolic syndrome X. And so we really want to get the highest quality and as much high quality protein into your diet as you can. So you want to look at new ways to get protein into your diet. Are you vegan? Do you eat eggs?
I do take egg in pastry, doctor, and I'd be happy to add it to my diet if it's needed.
I would. It would be great if you could do an egg or a couple of eggs for breakfast. That's the easiest to assimilate of most of the proteins, and that will then keep you from probably keep your carbohydrate intake down a little bit and also balance the swings in blood sugar that are probably occurring. And again, since your blood sugar is okay, this is very early stage, but this is a really early stage metabolic syndrome X pattern. Now, see, I don't believe, my personal belief from what I read, and it's not my belief like I just make it up in my head, but just from people that I trust, I believe that statins, the reason that they're as effective as they are is not because they lower cholesterol. It's because they actually do lower inflammation. And I think there are good ways that you can lower your inflammation. I need to do a show.
I have an alternate practitioner who started me on cinnamon every day, doctor.
Excellent. And do you eat cumin?
Yes.
C-U-M-I-N?
Yes, I do. It's part of our Indian diet in any case, so cumin is a standard.
And turmeric also, right?
Turmeric also, yes.
Yeah. So you want to make sure you're in. So you're probably getting lots of those, but with the cumin, that is great for the blood sugars. The cinnamon is great for blood sugars. I would actually, even though your blood sugars are okay, I would recommend kind of treating yourself like a pre-diabetic. So really working to increase your vegetable intake, lower your simple carbohydrate intake, increase your protein intake with the eggs, make sure you're getting some vegetable protein at every meal to start balancing these things out, and a little more probably intense, high-intensity, low-duration exercise, again, to get those...
All right. I run 5 kilometers a day, doctor, and I haven't had a sick day in 6-7 years now.
Excellent. Now what I want you to do is take 1 or 2 days a week to do sprints and not...
All right. I understand.
Okay? So go out. How long does it take you to run the 5 miles?
The 5 kilometers,
it takes me about
30 minutes. I'm doing about 9 kilometers an hour or so.
Okay. then what I want you to do is to go out and either in addition to that and probably in place of that is to go out one day a week and to do, you know, you've heard me talk about interval exercises. So go out and run some sprints. And that tells your body that you need to improve the sugar handling mechanisms.
That's the second point I wanted to speak to you about, Doctor. I have a resting heart rate which is about 70, 75 beats per minute. But by the time I do a brisk walk, it's up to 105.
Okay.
And by the time I'm doing 3 kilometers or so, it's up to about 162 beats per minute.
Okay.
And, you know, by the time I'm finished with my 5 kilometers, it's at 172.
Okay.
I've always been a high beater all my life, so I don't know if these are acceptable, non-acceptable. I recently heard you speak about eddies that are created in the heart if you have arrhythmias.
Yes. Do you have any arrhythmias
and,
that you're aware of?
Yes, sir. My treadmill test, which was part of this package that I just went through, the result says exercise stress test shows evidence of probable myocardial ischemia.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, then we've got to get those lipoproteins, I mean the triglycerides, down quickly. What happens is, you know, triglycerides are a type of fat, a type of lipid, and those bind to the carrier proteins. And those are what create the lipoproteins and leave the fatty deposits in the arteries. So those are the precursors. And so we've got to get those down, particularly with the ischemia, which is a lack of blood flow to the heart. I would really work on then 2 days a week doing interval training, because you've got to retrain the heart muscle a little bit, and we've got to get those fatty deposits down. So it's that's a little more dangerous. You need to move very quickly. I would also look, but the rhythm was okay. It was just a little ischemia.
That's right, sir.
Okay. I would get to an Ayurvedic doctor or a Chinese medical doctor over there and get a formula for coronary artery perfusion, for coronary artery opening. In Chinese medicine, we have quite a few of those. I know they have them in Ayurvedic medicine, certainly also. I'm just not familiar with which one you would want. And what you need, there are things that will start to clear the arteries. And you've certainly heard me talk about L-arginine. That's really...
Yes, sir. I was just going to ask you about that. L-arginine, natokinase, coenzyme Q10, these are things I should be adding?
Yes, all of those you should be adding. All of those three are very critical. You should probably also add serrapeptase, or in India they may have serratiopeptase, which is going to help start breaking down the fibrin deposits, which are likely there. And the L-arginine will start, you know, clearing the fatty deposits out of the interior of the arteries. So I would get...
What sort of quantities should I be taking these in, Doctor?
It's hard to say without seeing you. Typically, I will give patients 5 grams a day of L-arginine. There's a debate about whether the time-release form is better or not. I'm kind of coming around to starting to use more time release. There's a product that we get called Perfusia, which is a time release L-arginine, but I think either one is okay. I would typically, again, this isn't for you in specific because I haven't seen you, but typically I would give maybe 2,500 milligrams twice a day of the L-arginine. I would get a high-quality CoQ10, ubiquinol. There are also some good-quality ubiquinones coming out. So just get the best quality you can find and maybe do a couple hundred milligrams of that. And then the serratiopeptase, it really depends on the formulation, but I will typically have people do about 1,500 milligrams to 2,000 milligrams a day. And the serratiopeptase and the natokinase should be taken on an empty stomach. I'd also use some magnesium to help relax the arteries of the heart and to, you know, increase blood flow in that way.
Would something like night rest help, given that I'm a light sleeper as well?
Yeah, sure. Anything that's going... A lot of these... Most of the healing of the body occurs while we're asleep. The release of human growth hormone gets pulsed primarily at night and only if we're sleeping well. And human growth hormone is what keeps us young, right? Children have massive amounts, and as we get older, we have less and less. So a good night's sleep is critical. How old are you, Mahesh?
I'm 39, sir.
39, okay. Yeah, you're about the age where something like night dress could be beneficial. Night dress is a little more effective if you have trouble getting to sleep or wake up within a few hours. If you wake up later than that or, it's a problem later than that. Sometimes
no, sir, it's more like a light sleep. Any noise tends to wake me up.
Okay, something like that, a melatonin, or you might get a time-release melatonin, and night's rest, again, is a product that I use because I like the herbal component with it also. That can be very, very helpful, yes. Because the sleep,
last question that I had, any D3 or fish oil that I need to add?
Say that again?
Any D3 vitamins or fish oil
Have you had your D3 levels tested?
No, sir. I'm afraid it wasn't part of the test. I should get it tested.
The average to maintain appropriate vitamin D levels is about 4,000 to 5,000 units a day. I don't know how much sun you get in the area that you're in, where you live. If you're
we get enough sun.
Okay, I would do probably. I've never seen anybody that didn't have sarcoidosis that it hurt to do 5,000 units a day just to be safe. And if you're willing to do fish oil, that could be the best thing for you. Again, I didn't know if you'd be willing to do that. But, yes, in order to get HDL up, fish oil is one of the best things, that and the interval exercise.
Can I do that in a capsule and not have to take it as an oil, and that would still work?
Capsules are fine.
All right. That's wonderful, Doctor. Thank you so much. You've been such a great help, and, it's really so empowering to listen to you and to be able to take action about our health on our own. Thank you so much, and thanks also to Mrs. Neeters, who's the one who gave me the number and asked me to call.
Yeah, she does all the real work.
Thank you.
She does all the real work, just so you know. Mahesh, I'm so delighted that you called, and it makes my heart warm just to think that there are people out there that are and the word you used, I used to be the president. I was the vice president for quite a while and the president for a short period of time of an organization called Empowerment back in the 1980s, and that is 100% my goal, is to create empowerment. And I don't use that term a lot anymore, but it's very gratifying to me that you use it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, sir. God bless. Thank you.
Okay. Excellent. That's very exciting. I want to mention something. There was an article that Andrew Rubman, I think is where I saw it, but it was about Xanax. And it's interesting. You know, Xanax is a very old drug not very old, but a pretty old drug. It's 30 years old or so. And but just recently, the Centers for Disease Control issued a report saying that Xanax has become one of the leading causes of drug overdose. And this was in Florida that they reported it in particular, but it's really a problem nationwide. And I have lots of patients that come in on Xanax. And they were saying that fatal overdoses of prescription drugs, by the way, fatal overdoses, prescription drugs given by doctors, are 4 times as common as overdoses caused by illicit drugs like heroin and cocaine. So the drug problem is just as much or more so in legal drugs. In fact, it is obviously much more of a problem than it is with illegal drugs. And part of it is that people assume that since their doctor recommended it or gave it to them, that it must be safe. This is absolutely inherently untrue. There are none that I'm aware of drugs that are absolutely safe. They all have the potential for harm. Most of them have the potential to do good. But you really have to do your homework and be careful. And I've had patients who've come into me and said, I need to do some work on anxiety. You know, I get very anxious, and I say, does it happen? Is it all the time, or is it just occasional? Only when I fly. And I'll say, do you have a prescription? They say, yeah, I have a prescription for Xanax. And I'll say, do you only use it when you fly? And they say, yes. And I'll say, then use the Xanax. You know, follow your doctor's advice. I don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is when drugs that are really best used for short-term become long-term usage. And that's where you see the real potential for problems. So if it's an acute thing, you know, there's been an emergency, there's been a horrible life event, or you're going to fly, you know, once a year, well, the drugs are fine probably. But if it's a lifestyle thing, if you're anxious every day, if you have anxiety, really, you know, you probably want to consider doing something alternative because of the severe dangers of these drugs. The prescriptions for these drugs are going up very dramatically. In the U.S., now this is a 30-year-old drug, but there were 37.5 million prescriptions, 37.5 million prescriptions for this one drug last year, and this is only one of many drugs in this category. So that's 40% increase over the last 5 years. 30-year-old drug seeing a 40% increase in the last 5 years. And often it's being given to people that don't have some of the problems that it was originally prescribed for. And so anyway, it is a real problem. So we've got Ativan, Klonopin, Valium. They work slightly differently, but all of these benzodiazepines have a real potential for abuse, particularly if they're ever combined with alcohol, and that's where a lot of the deaths come in, a lot of the overdoses. Xanax, a lot of people like because it works a little faster, and it's out of the system faster. But they're all very dangerous. Now, Xanax works very effectively. It's a very effective drug. It's a GABA, G-A-B-A, gamma-aminobutyric acid. It's a GABA agonist, and that means it increases the potential and the ability of GABA to do its job. Now, other GABA agonists include magnesium. Magnesium glycinate is a GABA agonist. Obviously not as strong as Xanax, but I find a lot of my patients, once we get them doing enough magnesium and some herbs, the majority of them are able to give up the regular usage of these very dangerous benzodiazepines. And again, you don't ever want to go off of those drugs, any of them, without, if you've been on them for any length of time, you don't ever want to go off them without working with your medical doctor. They are very dangerous to get off of. So never go off of them against medical advice. Always work with your doctor. I'm happy to work with patients when they're working with their doctors to get them off of these drugs, and we have a very good success rate. I don't have the information in front of me, but I gave it out last week. The Taoist gathering, the Jidao Quan gathering, is coming up this weekend, and that is Friday afternoon and all day Saturday and Sunday. So if you have a chance, and these are done as one to five hour little workshops, so you don't have to go the whole time, but check out Jidao Quan. It'll be on our website, and I'm going to be over there for several of those events, and hopefully I'll see you over there this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Let's go ahead and take one more quick call here. I hear there's a call. Hi, this is Dr. Nieders.
Hi, Jones.
Oh, hi, Kent.
Hi. I don't have time to ask much question. If I may make a few comments.
Okay.
The PSA, about the PSA, one of the things that's interesting about it is that even though regular sexual activity is good for the prostate, PSA, I hear, is raised a little bit after sexual activity for a day or so.
Yes, anything that stimulates the prostate will cause an increase in PSA levels. Now, it's not a huge increase usually from sex, but, yeah, it absolutely makes a difference.
So it can make a slightly artificially high reading, so maybe waiting, you know, abstaining a day or two before the test.
Yeah, and most doctors, you know, are great with this, and they don't rely certainly on a single test. They're going to check people over time. But, you know, it's always good to remind people of that, to really take it with a grain of salt. It's a valuable test, but you don't want to over-rely on it.
Okay. The other comment is, Now, I think I've heard that taurine is an amino acid that's good for regulating the heartbeat, and I think that vegetarians have a hard time getting enough of that one. Have you heard about that?
I know it is definitely involved in regulating the heartbeat. I have a few products that we use for heart health that do have a little additional taurine in it. I'm a little embarrassed. I don't know all the sources for taurine, actually. So I'm going to have to check that out. I don't know where all it comes from.
Okay.
That is a problem. Again, with my vegetarian patients, and I respect that lifestyle. I was a vegetarian, vegan for most
certainly.
Of 20 years. But it is tricky. You know, I talked about the Hindu population in London when they started dying of B12 deficiency, and they couldn't figure it out because they had the exact same diet that they had in India. And then some enterprising public health official went to India and found that in the area these people lived that there were enough, you know, bugs in the food that they were actually getting enough B12.
Oh,
but when they started to eat really, really, quote, clean food, then they weren't getting any B12. So it's tricky. You know, it's more difficult to eat a healthy diet, I think, in many ways, when one is a vegetarian.
Right. As far as, like, say, getting omega-3s, I hear that the fish get their omega-3s from eating the plankton.
Yes.
I don't know if they do an internal conversion to DHA.
They do. It's from the 18 hydrocarbon length of ALA, then you go up to the 20 for EPA and 22 for DHA. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but each of those conversions is six steps. And if there is a lot of stress or alcohol use or hormone replacement, anything, things that affect almost all Americans, you can't do the conversion. If you're really healthy and under the best of circumstances, there's a debate, but essentially it's about 1-5% can get converted to up-converted to these very long hydrocarbon chains, these very long omega-3 acids, fatty acids. But in most of us, we can't do it, and that's one of the problems. And that's why, you know, if you were a vegetarian 200 years ago or living in an Essene community, you could probably be fine. But now, very difficult, very difficult.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
All righty.
Okay.
Have fun.
You too. Thanks.
Yeah. Hope to see you out there this weekend at the Taoist Gathering. And, Dave and I are creating several new shows for the Medicine Men. We haven't done any for a while, and they've been a lot of repeats. But tune in, tune in Monday morning for another edition of the Medicine Men. That's at 7 a.m. on Monday. And then I will be back at 9 to do a new edition of the Balancing Point. I apologize. Last Monday, I had to go to a funeral on very short notice and be a speaker, so didn't get to do a new show. But I will be here next Monday to do a new show on The Balancing Point. So thank you, be happy, be healthy, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you very much.
This station is a